help of many others. We helped each other.
From my background research, it seemed to be quite a busy time and I don't want to say crazy time, but I'm not sure how else to put it.
How did you want to do this?
Well, I have a little piece I want to say at the beginning.
Okay.
All right. Now, one quick question. Do you pronounce your name Izant or Izant?
Izant.
Okay. Okay. To begin, my name is Tammy Vandermolen, and I'm here with Carol Izant to record our oral history. This is Monday, December 1st, 2014, and we are at the Shangri-La Cafe in Detroit. And I want to thank you for taking the time and allowing me to do this interview. This is part of my oral history class, LIS 7770, for Wayne State University. To begin with, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, where you've lived, your education and such?
Okay, I was born January 24th, 1954, in Cleveland, Ohio. My parents had met at college. They both went to Miami University of Ohio and were college sweethearts. My dad was from Cleveland, my mom was from Pittsburgh, so after they married, they settled in Cleveland. My dad went to work for the Cleveland Twist Reel Company. When I was almost three, he was relocated to the Baltimore area with his job, and so we moved. I was the oldest child as well, and so we moved outside of Baltimore and lived there for the next 17 years. I graduated from high school there. I have one younger brother. He was born in Baltimore. And, you know, so this is where I grew up. My parents were very active outdoors people. My dad was quite an avid sailor. So I grew up sailing on the Chesapeake Bay. And we also have a family vacation home in Western New York State. My grandparents owned this, and so every summer period, several times over the course of the summer, we would drive from Baltimore to Bemis Point, which on Lake Chautauqua, and where we also did a lot of sailing, a lot of outdoor activities. I was active in Scouts. I was active in the church growing up. My mother was quite the activist herself, really. She was involved in the civil rights movement, and she certainly set the example for me of, you know, what it means to be an engaged citizen. And she took a lot of flack, I think, from my dad's family, but my father was always, you know, very supportive of my mother, you know, everything that she was involved with. The church, her social activism, but you know, at the same time, she was you know, very, very dedicated wife and mother. So, but I saw that that model of volunteer work, you know, set forth by my mother, which really impressed me, and I do think that my involvement in the Girl Scouts also really helps to develop leadership in young women. And I was active in Scouts from third grade to the ninth grade, and I had an aunt who was a Girl Scout leader, and she was also very encouraging. My grandmother was very encouraging in terms of you know, getting an education and etc. So I had a lot of strong women around me that set a really positive example for me.
Sounds like it.
And, you know, when I graduated from high school, I went off to college in Pennsylvania for a couple of years. I was on a pre-med program, but that after a couple of years, it was clear to everyone that I was not mentally or emotionally, psychologically prepared to be a good student at that time in my life. So I exited there. Meanwhile, my parents had moved to Michigan. So this is how I got to Detroit.
Ah, okay.
I got a job, worked for a couple years, did some traveling with a friend of mine, came to Detroit, decided I was going to go back to school, decided that I was going to really try my hand at going to art school, because this was certainly always, you know, I had always, as a child, been very active, you know, in the arts. So that's what I turned my attentions to, and that has continued to provide a tremendous, you know, outlet for growth and development for me. But in high school, I got it, you know, my mom was active in the civil rights movement. Well, of course, in the late 60s, there was the anti-war movement with the Vietnam War. Then you have the beginnings of the environmental movement, the first, you know, Earth Day in 1970. My high school formed an ecology and hiking club. I was part of all of that. I was elected to a seat, you know, in my senior class, elected to a position. You know, I was a class officer and involved in, like, you know, more clubs and sports and activities. So, I mean, I have been an activist
since the beginning.
All my life. I've been active in lots and lots of all kinds of ways. So, really, when I moved downtown, moved to Detroit, and started going to school at Wayne, and got involved in the art scene, that too was a really, well, you know, creative exploration, something that I really hadn't given myself much of an opportunity to be involved with since I was a child. And but, you know, I was talented, but I lacked focus. So in many ways it was kind of an unsatisfactory kind of a period in my life. I had a lot of talent, but I didn't have much direction, and so, you know, what did I end up doing? I ended up getting married and having a baby. And that sort of galvanized my focus.
And which it does, yes.
And thank God for that. So after, really when my son was 2 years old, is when a few of us in this neighborhood learned about the proposed, you know, incinerator only just, you know, a mile from here. And really it was, you know, it was at the suggestion of a friend of mine that she said, you know, you might want to get involved in this. And so I went to a hearing at the city council chambers in April of 1986, and it just boggled my brain. There were like over 500 people crowding into the city council chambers, and at this time there was a miscalculation in the health risk that had become known, and so there was a question about how could the state even consider issuing a permit to build this thing, knowing that the health risk was like just off the chart. But the response was, well, we've already issued our license to build, and so now if we pull it back, we're going to get sued.
Right.
And that was, so it was, you know, from the beginning, there was a legal challenge. As Lois Gibbs, Director of Citizens Health for Environmental Justice, this is Lois Gibbs of the Love Canal.
Okay.
She got involved with us, you know, early on. And as Lois will tell you, legal battles empower lawyers. And if you don't have the money to fight a good legal battle, then you have to empower people.
Right.
And the group that became the Evergreen Alliance had a total commitment to trying to engage in direct action strategies that would bring notice to the issue. We were not polite. We were not going through business as usual channels. We were not hiring lawyers because we didn't have any money to hire lawyers.
Right.
But we had several people in the leadership of our organization that knew a lot about media and how to attract attention in the media. So what did I know? All I know is, you know, I decided that I was in on this. I mean, right from the very beginning, I was just totally engaged. It was obviously the artist in me that was really engaged in what I saw as a very dynamic, creative process that was unfolding, a collaborative kind of a people power, you know, that brought me into an awareness of politics and, you know, big money, and, you know, it forced me to re-examine just about everything that I thought I knew. You know, I mean, I was quite naive. You know, I mean, I was raised to believe that, you know, the people in a leadership role in our government know what they're doing.
Right.
And
you come to Detroit and find out otherwise.
And, well, I didn't have to come to Detroit to find that out, but that's where I ended up. You know, but so one thing led to another, and we were a merry band of Pied Pipers, and we just through our arts and our activism and our theater and our music and our words and our puppet making, we formed this great big kind of collaborative, creative collective that took to the streets with our actions. And at the same time, you know, we were going to all the meetings and the hearings and trying to really educate ourselves to identify people outside of Detroit that had expertise about all of this stuff, all of this business, and people seemed to really want to come to Detroit and talk to us about what we were doing. And so little by little, Greenpeace became very interested in the kind of work we did because it was so much like the work they did.
Right.
You know, and Lois Gibbs with the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste, and talked to Paul Connett, you know, who's been active in New York State, and Dr. Barry Commoner came, and a lot of like really heavy hitters, you know, came to Detroit to talk with us about how this fight in Detroit over this proposed world's largest trash incinerator, why this was such a big deal. You know.
So you brought it to their attention, and they helped take it and run with it.
Mm-hmm. And so we developed a more sophisticated kind of a critique. There were a couple of us in the group who were concerned about the fact that, so much of the kind of work that we did and the kind of a critique that we developed was a very I don't want to use the word elitist, but a very a much more politically sophisticated kind of an argument. But what I really started to connect the dots on was the fact that, you know, not only was what I was working for was environmental protection, but really it was a question of social justice. And how I got turned on to that idea was there was a woman, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, who came to Detroit in May of 87 with a conference called Women, Peace, and the Environment. And she was really very nationally and internationally known for her work on nuclear power.
Okay.
And the problems of the moral question that is raised due to the fact that most of the uranium mining in this country takes place on Indian reservations, and that there was this tremendous sacrifice of indigenous peoples' lands for the sake of this nuclear power industry, which of course is so married to the military industrial complex because it's so linked in with our weapons program and all of that. So that's a separate topic. But she came to Detroit to talk, and she talked about the notion of communities being sacrificed, toxic sacrifice communities. And all of a sudden, bam, the light bulb went on for me, and I thought, this is what's happening to Detroit.
Right.
That we are being, you know, abused. You know, it is a very systematic injustice, racial injustice that's going on, not only about race, but about poverty, because the combination of poverty and race, is those are the twin issues that allow these kinds of terrible, you know, toxic polluters to be able to do what they do. I met a woman that worked in Southwest Detroit, and she had been engaged in a lot of toxics issues in the Southwest Detroit area. I don't know if many of you folks are looking at Southwest Detroit in your environmental justice project.
I think one or two of them are, yes.
But I can't imagine you wouldn't be. But anyway, her name is Brenda Liveoak, and she was very interested in the work that we were doing on the Detroit Incinerator. So I remember, you know, calling her up and introducing myself. And before you know it, she really, she just sucked me right in, you know. So I got myself a serious education. And talking to her, as I kept saying, you know, Brenda, we can't just look at it as a problem of environmental pollution. We have to really see it as question of social justice. And she just glommed right onto that, and she connected the dots. There was another one of my comrades named Tom Stevens. He also really connected the dots on the environmental justice issue. I know he's being interviewed for this project as well. He's an attorney that went on and wrote the Michigan Environmental Justice.
I think I've seen his name in my research.
Yeah, so yeah. And so it was Tom and myself with the Evergreen Alliance that got really interested in the environmental justice component. And with that, of course, we needed to start to really reach out to the African American community here in Detroit, which is, at the time, was pretty challenging. Coleman Young was our mayor at that time.
Yeah.
He had made it quite clear to community groups and neighborhood block groups that if they, you know, came out publicly against the Detroit Incinerator Project, that he would take away their funding.
Oh.
And because this was Coleman's baby, you know. Now, I can tell you right now that I believe that Coleman Young thought he was doing a good thing for the city of Detroit, that he got sold a bill of goods. He got sold on the idea of, you know, we're gonna burn garbage.
We're gonna get rid of
we're gonna boil water. We're gonna generate steam. We're gonna make electricity. We're gonna be able to sell electricity and make money for the city of Detroit. And at the same time, we're gonna eliminate all these landfills.
Yes.
So I genuinely believe that he got sold a bill of goods by the waste incinerator industry, and it was going to be a win-win.
He was told only half the story.
Certainly he was only told half the story, but nevertheless there was this huge financial commitment to take this on, and so he was very invested in making sure that, you know, nobody said bad things about the Detroit incinerator.
Right.
So, to the extent that community groups and block club groups and neighborhood groups were made to feel that if they came out in any kind of public way to support us, that they could risk their funding. So we had to, go about our education and our outreach into the African American community. We had to find our friends, you know,
right,
as best we could. And so the good news about the Detroit Incinerator today is that we don't have to find our friends in the African American community anymore, because they have organized themselves, because
yes,
it's become quite clear that what the problem is. And so I don't have to champion the Detroit incinerator issue anymore because now a lot of other people have taken it on.
Those that are directly affected and those in the area.
Well, I mean, I lived in the area.
Right.
But, you know, no matter how much time I spend in the sun, I'm still, I'm going to be viewed as a white person.
Right.
You know, and that makes a difference in a lot of times in the ability to attract people to the concerns that you have.
And trying to get them to understand it's also their concern.
Well, sure, absolutely. But the good news is that there is a lot of people involved in this issue now.
Good.
And I've been able to go on and do other things.
Great. I think you just answered about 6 or 8 of my questions.
Okay.
All at one time.
Yeah. So, and I mean, there are certainly, it was for 7 years. I mean, 7 solid years from 86 to 93. This
wow.
is pretty much all I did. Now one thing led to another, and before you knew it, I was like saying yes to coming to everybody's meeting in town, and really, I mean, I realized that, I was so interested in knowing who the people were that were interested in what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I started getting myself invited to everybody else's group in town, and it kept branching out and further out into covering the whole Southeast Michigan. And we were able to pull more and more people into our demonstrations and our meetings and what have you. And it was very exciting. And again, so Greenpeace had the campaign in 1990-91, Great Lakes Basin-wide campaign. They saw that I had the ability to organize.
Right.
And so they asked me if I would take on a job as the grassroots organizer for this campaign. So, not really knowing what I was getting myself into, I said yes. And then my whole little world,
expanded
a whole nother quantum shift. Now I'm not just going to meetings in Southeast Michigan, now I'm going to meetings all over the Great Lakes Basin.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Meanwhile, my son is still growing up, and my husband is still going to work, and I'm still managing my apartment buildings, and I had worked at Harper Hospital over here in the medical center for a long time, just part-time. Then I got laid off, and so I was able to devote most of my efforts to this, to this movement. Until my contract expired with Greenpeace at the end of 1991, and so all systems kind of started to collapse in on me, and I realized I needed, to get a job.
Well, you probably by that time needed a short break.
Yeah.
To gather yourself together.
We were calling, the Zero Discharge Alliance was calling for the elimination of the production, use, and disposal of chlorine.
Okay.
Which is, when it's combined, it tends to bioaccumulate. It binds with a lot of other chemicals and forms a persistent toxic in the environment. As of particular concern, with water quality
right.
here in the Great Lakes. But incinerators, when you burn plastic, forms dioxins, burning cadmium. There's a lot of chlorine products that are created in the incineration project. So that's how I got involved in this from that end.
They kind of built on each other.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
realization popped in.
Yeah. Now, again, now that I'm involved, I'm sort of very directly in my anti-nuke work the last 3 years, much to my irony, it's the company that designed and built the Detroit incinerator is a company called Combustion Engineering. They were formerly in the business of building nuclear reactors, but after Three Mile Island in 1979, business for nuclear power went down, So they figured, well, we'll just build waste to energy, you know, incinerators, and we'll burn garbage to boil water instead of splitting atoms to boil water. But, you know, but it's all about, so really what it's all about for me all these years is about safe energy.
Right.
I mean, I realize more and more that this is what I've been working on, is to try to, you know, help educate people to think deeply about, you know, safe energy and what it means ultimately to live more gently on the earth, you know, to lead have a life that is not all about just mindless consumerism,
right,
and, you know, increased energy use, and just increasing footprint on the planet, but to figure out ways to reduce our footprint, to live more gently, to have a way of living together, with, still with electricity, but not to the extent that we risk terrible harm to human health and to the environment, you know,
to the planet itself.
Yes,
yeah.
And we are seeing, you know, the limits of this starting to take effect. You know, the science is already there.
The science is already there. It's just finding how we can do it the best way.
Yeah. How do we shrink our economy without collapsing it? How do we power down? How do we? It's no easy trick.
No, it's not. It's not.
But it's an important. It's from my point of view, it's the most important subject on the table.
It is very important. I agree to that. Yes.
Yes. If you have any vested interest in your children, your grandchildren, your great grandchildren, and all the children of all the species on the planet, we want to ensure that there will be a life for them.
That's true. And right now, we don't know that.
No, and at the rate things are going, it's not a pretty picture.
No.
Yeah.
Was there any one protest during
yeah,
that kind of stood out in your memory?
Well, of course, getting arrested and going to jail.
so you did have that experience.
That was a memorable day. Yeah, that was June 5th of 1989. And this was a demonstration that was organized by sort of like the women's, the group of women that formed kind of as an offshoot to the Evergreen Alliance.
Okay.
We called ourselves WEAVE, Women Empowered Against Violence to the Environment.
Okay.
And so we took on a major organizing demonstration, activist demonstration, and we rallied about 500 people one day to the gates at the incinerator, and we had a blockade.
Ah.
And there were, I don't know, there were a couple dozen of us that got arrested that day and got sent off to jail. It's memorable to me for a lot of different reasons, but certainly significant was the fact that my son was about five at the time, five or six. Yeah, five, going on six, yeah. And so we're there. He says to his dad as the police are taking me away, "But Daddy, I thought you said Mommy was doing a good thing." And my husband says, "Well, son, she is doing a good thing." And he said, "Well, then why are the police taking her away, Daddy?" And so he knew that we had raised money for our bail, because it was our intention to get arrested in this civil disobedience action.
Okay.
So as my husband and my son are leaving, he says to my husband, "Daddy, I think we're going to have to go back to the bank. Mom's going to need more money." And when I got out of jail that day, the first thing he said was, "Mommy, I hope you've learned your lesson." And I said, "Yes, I hope they've learned theirs too." So, but, you know, out of the mouth of babes, you know.
The truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was right. Mom was definitely going to need more money. Mother Earth, you know, it's like, and that's how I kind of have taken that comment, that yes, Mother Earth needs
more money,
more people engaged in this kind of work, and it does cost money. You know, legal battles cost money, you know, supporting an organization that's dedicated to any kind of a mission such as this requires funding, you know. So that kind of leads me to my next segue. So, okay, so at this point, you know, I'm out of a job with Greenpeace. I go to work for this food co-op. It used to be down the street. So I'm working with them. And life goes on. My husband convinces me that maybe it's time to kind of back off a little bit from the environmental movement. You know, he says, I'm not telling you to stop, but you're going to have to recognize the fact that your son is growing up. He's got his own ideas of, you know, what he wants to do, Cub Scouts, sports,
right,
homework, school, blah, 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 friends. He said, you know, if you don't, like, stop and pay attention, he's going to, like, be grown, and then you'll just wonder what happened. So, of course, he was right, so I did. I stopped, and I remember... this was before cell phones and email, and I only had an answering machine on my telephone.
Okay.
And I remember, you know, I took the dramatic move to unplug my answering machine, which was, felt like political suicide, you know, that I was, you know, unplugging.
Right.
But it was really good. It was really good to finally just kind of take some time out. And that timeout lasted about 7 years. But meanwhile, I was able to go back to art school. I was able to start to kind of, I felt like, you know, I had given so much of myself in this one direction.
Right.
I needed to start to round out, you know, and, you know, was able to get back to work, get back to school, eventually finished my degree in art. You know, it was actually... an art class I had called Art and Artifact, where we went out to the Cranbrook Science Museum. We were able to go through all their collections. And I came across this artifact that was made from caribou bone. It was from Inuit culture.
Okay.
And one of the last things I had done, you know, before I took the big time out, was I had gone to a program that the Sierra Club put together about the problems of the proposed drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. And they brought a bunch of Gwich'in Native American people to Detroit, and they talked about their way of life and how this was going to be impacted by the destruction of the caribou habitat. And they were very, they called themselves the caribou people. And their way of life was really dependent on having that sort of intact, you know, relationship with the caribou. So anyway, came across this artifact made out of caribou. I had this really quite profound emotional, psychological, spiritual moment, and I just thought, I have to get back involved in this environmental movement because I know too much. It's like,
yes.
I'm someone who, I don't know why I've been chosen to, you know, have this kind of have such an engaged type of an effort, you know, because there is a lot of sacrifice,
yes,
you know, involved in this work. It's not easy work. It's, you know, largely unpaid. There is a cost involved in this, but I really felt so moved by this experience that I just thought, I have to get back. I got to get back at it. And the only thing that, you know, I realized after all this other work I had done previously is that I didn't want to keep on having to reach into my own pocket,
right,
to finance this work. So I looked and I also knew that I had to get more active with the politics. Like it or not, our elected leaders make real decisions that impact policy.
Yes.
And like it or not, it's real. So I looked around and I realized that I thought the Sierra Club would be a good organization for me to get involved with. Had national name recognition, had a local group I could get involved with. It has a democratic, you know, structure. It's fundamentally a grassroots organization, but well-funded. And
that was one key right there.
And they do the politics. And they get they engage in electoral politics. So that was in 2000. I got involved, joined the political committee for the Southeast Michigan group, the Sierra Club, and then didn't take very long. Before you know it, I'm the program chair. I'm ordering the monthly meetings for them, and you know, 3 years later, you know, I'm chairing the Southeast Michigan group. So I did that for 10 years. I was involved with the Sierra Club. And again, I needed to take some time out again. My parents, you know, became sick, and it was their kind of end of life story, and I got really involved with their care. So I backed away again from a lot of my environmental work, and they passed 4 years ago. So that kind of coincided with the end of my run with the Sierra Club, and then I took some time out again. But I found out about, I had known about the proposed third nuclear reactor at the Fermi site near Monroe. I knew about that from the beginning because one of my closest colleagues in all of this is a guy named Michael Keegan. He lives in Monroe, and he has been in the vanguard of the anti-nuke movement here in the Great Lakes for years, 40 years, and I had known him because he had come to Detroit to do a lot of support with the Evergreen Alliance years ago. So anyway, I was always aware of this proposal, but then after Fukushima, March 11th, 2011, it really hit home with me, and then wasn't long, and there was an effort to try to form an anti-nuke group, so here I am, co-chairing the Alliance to Halt Fermi 3. Now, going into our fourth year.
Yeah.
So
it's
there's
just
no end to all of it.
It's just amazing how it has just rolled one into another with just short breaks in there for you to regain your life, so to speak.
The good news is that, you know, I've managed to stay married through all of this. I've raised a brilliant son. My son owns his own company. He's involved in the whole energy efficiency world. We talk safe energy all the time. I mean, this is what he's all about. He says, "Mom, I wouldn't be doing anything that I'm doing today if it wasn't for everything that you've done."
Right.
So that's, of course, you know, that makes Mom feel really good. And so it's awesome. And I'm still, you know, I'm working on my art as I can, but I feel like I've been able to marry the artist and the activist. You know, I mean, of course I've been a businesswoman all these years. You know, would not have been able to do what I've done without the kind of financial base that my husband, for his work and our business, have provided us.
And without his support.
Oh, well, without his support. He is the unsung hero in all of this.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm the one who's, you know, who's always got the agenda that won't quit. You know, but he is, yes, the unsung hero who's supported me.
And it's always good to have someone behind you like that.
Mm-hmm. Even though he's not always very happy about it. Oftentimes he's definitely not happy about it.
Especially when the little one is asking, "Is Mom going to jail?" Why is Mom going to jail?
Well, I mean, that was actually a proud day because my husband knew exactly why I was going to jail.
Good.
So other than that, just a note, the video clip that I sent to you.
Yes.
I was not at that.
Okay.
I was not at that demonstration.
Okay, I thought you had mentioned that you were in the back of that.
Not me.
It must have been somebody else's reply when
this
email
was the day my husband dragged me kicking and screaming. This was the day we moved.
Oh.
And I was like, no, you don't understand. I'm supposed to be at a demonstration today.
Okay.
He said, no, we're moving.
That was someone else in that email string then.
That was, you said, yeah. We're moving. Had we not, had I prevailed that day, I would have been part of the group that got arrested. But my husband prevailed, we moved.
Well, it and
moving day.
From that protest, from that video clip, your protests were peaceful.
Oh, sure.
You know, there was a lot of singing and a lot of talking and discussion. And of course, some got picked up and put on the bus.
Yeah.
But there was nothing, you know, that was seriously unlawful.
No, there was nothing violent. No attempts at arson or sabotage or anything like that. No.
Now, you mentioned earlier your art worked into it some. I remember reading in one of the articles about puppet heads.
Right.
Were you part of that?
Yeah.
Building those?
Yeah, there was one woman in particular, her name's Kathy Rashid. She's an artist, very well-known artist in this area. And she kind of took the lead on this puppet making, you know, aspect of what we did. But certainly I was one of the worker bees, you know. Yeah, my skills were really, I was the person who saw how what we were doing in our little, you know, world was connected to all these other fights.
Okay.
You know, all these other grassroots struggles. And I was very interested, like I say, in knowing what other people were doing. Because in some ways our group was quite introverted. You know, we were kind of pretty insulated and introverted in the way we went about things.
Okay.
And I wanted to learn from others. So while a lot of my comrades with the Evergreen Alliance, they weren't as interested in what other people were doing.
Okay.
But I was very interested, and that's how I developed the reputation as the organizer.
Okay.
Because I started to know all these people that were involved in all these other local grassroots efforts.
That takes a lot of coordination.
Yeah.
And knocking on doors and shaking hands.
Yeah, and like spending endless, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours on the telephone, because at that time we didn't have email to connect us.
Right.
We didn't have listservs and email. We didn't have cell phones. It was, you know, you either go in person, go to where other groups are meeting, and identify yourself and introduce yourself and talk about what we're doing, listen to others, da da da. And a lot of it was on the phone.
Do you think it would have been more successful or less successful if social media had been around?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question.
With social media, it could have been blown out of proportion by the wrong people.
You know, I am constantly being encouraged by the young people that I'm involved with in the anti-nuke work that
right.
I do to get more involved with social media. But I'm still kind of an old school organizer. It's like, you know, Cesar Chavez said, first you talk to one person, then you talk to another one.
Right.
Then you talk to another one after that, and then another one. And I still think it's so much about establishing a personal relationship with people, so making some kind of personal connection.
Okay.
Because why should I bother to come and get involved with what you're doing if I don't even feel like there's any kind of a personal connection
right.
between you? And I don't have a Facebook account. I don't Twitter. I'm not plugged in into that world. And a lot of people say you're never going to be as successful in reaching young people until you do. So I don't know. I'm still very. I'm not convinced that that's going to be my role.
Right. Maybe one of the young people who keeps suggesting role.
That's right.
And then you
I am going to start a youth committee, and you youth person, you're going to organize it. You're going to set it up.
Because there are more like of our age, your contemporaries, that are not as plugged in,
right,
either as or at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so a young person on Twitter and Facebook and everything else is not going to be able to reach them, but they would be effective and helpful with the organization.
Right.
But same goes for the young people.
Right.
They need that cyber contact.
Right.
For some reason. I'm not sure why.
I'm not saying that it's not effective.
Right.
I'm just probably not going to do it.
I can totally understand.
Because I really like being able to have, just certain kind of boundaries in my life that allow me to continue to have a personal life, a private life,
right,
the life of an artist, a contemplative world that can sustain me
right,
at the center of who I am as a human being.
Yes.
And that's so important, especially as you get older, because otherwise you really risk your health.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Speaking of artists, has any of your artwork been affected, or does it reflect?
Occasionally.
Occasionally.
Mm-hmm. It has.
Okay.
And I have there's a young man on my board right now with this anti-nuke group, and he's always encouraging me to turn more of my art into sort of an activist kind of venue for my activism, but he's not an artist, so he
doesn't see the person or the personality within the art that might be taken away if it's pushed into the activism.
Yeah. I mean, he's very interested in our issue getting out there through any means necessary. And so he would like me to use my talents to this end. But my talents at this time in history are I'm still, the organizer, and more and more the person who knows how to write grants and get funding and raise money for the group. So I'm still the businesswoman.
The businesswoman, want to be or not.
There's a great quote. I can't remember if it's Alice Walker or Maya Angelou or Toni Morrison. One of those three women says, "Activism is the rent that I must pay for the privilege of living on planet Earth." And as a landlady of 35 years, I know about, paying the rent.
Yes.
Collecting the rent. And so that really speaks to me in a very direct way. And so, yes, maybe this is the rent all these years, this activism I've been engaged in, is the rent that I have paid.
Right.
All these years. I continue to, people do recognize, my leadership, and I appreciate that. I was nominated for Michigan Environmentalist of the Year in 1991.
Good.
By the Michigan Environmental Council. I got the Spirit of Detroit Award in 2006 for environmental justice. I've gotten awards from the Sierra Club. I mean, I've, not that that's what it's about, but it's been great to, have some recognition for my work. But more importantly is the fact that I'm able to, I'm able to draw people in, to roll up their sleeves and do this work. And I like to think that we're having some fun at it at the same time. Girls just want to have fun.
Well, that's true. That's
true. We have to work really hard. We work really hard. Most women I know work very hard.
We work very hard at it, but we want it to be enjoyable too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's true. So. This Fermi.
Yeah.
Alliance to Halt, Fermi 3.
Yeah.
You brought me a handout, which I'll include in the packet.
Oh, beautiful.
If I can have it.
Most definitely.
Do you find that this is as difficult to get across to people as...
Oh, this is a lot more difficult.
A lot more difficult?
Yeah. Can't see it, can't taste it, can't smell it. It's very removed from the public eye.
Okay.
Most people don't really understand what nuclear power is to begin with. What is it? How did you say you do that again? but all the everything about it, you know, the mining, the milling, the processing, all of it. It's a very expensive, dirty, and dangerous way to go about boiling water.
And the disposal.
There's no real good answer to what they do with the radioactive waste.
Right.
That's why. That's clearly the Achilles heel of the project. And then there's all kinds of government subsidies we wouldn't even have nuclear power if it wasn't for all the government subsidies. But that's true for most extractive industries, you know, coal, oil.
Right.
You know, I mean, they wouldn't. The financing of all of that would not be as attractive, you know, without all the kind of subsidies that go in. So, but all it takes is one bad day, and then you have a radiologic nightmare.
Right.
You know, you got a problem at a wind farm. Well, that's a mechanical problem. So, I mean, some birds might get hurt. Some people might get hurt. You know, if you had some kind of a mechanical failure, but that's the extent of it. You're not unleashing some monster, some Godzilla onto, you know, a region. I mean, to this day, we have no idea what the fallout's going to be from Fukushima.
No.
That's just continuing to, this story is just continuing to unfold.
And you don't hear much in the news that I've seen.
No, you have to seek it out.
Right.
And that's true with any of the news. Yeah. There was a big article in the Detroit Free Press a few weeks ago about Michigan's energy future. And, you know, there was not word one mention of, you know, the proposed Fermi 3. There was not one word mentioned about Fermi 2. There's not a word mentioned about Cook and Palisades on the west side of the state. It's as if nuclear power it wasn't even like on the radar.
But yet they're still working.
Oh yeah, and if all you do is watch television, you think DTE is building wind farms and promoting energy efficiency. Whereas meanwhile, no, it's a far more sinister operation. So, you know, I don't know what to tell you. But it all boils down to trying to help educate people to understand what a safe energy future, you know, would look like. What
right.
a sustainable, safe energy future could look like.
Do you expect to... This is a homegrown alliance to halt Fermi 3. Have you had any contact from the other organizations for support?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have 17... right now, we have about 600 people on our mailing list. These are 17 member organizations.
Okay.
And yet, we're very networked in with the national anti-nuke groups.
Okay.
Definitely.
And I see you have an annual meeting and holiday tea on December 7th.
That's right. Coming right up.
Coincidentally on Pearl Harbor Day.
That's right. So when you have a minute, you know, take the time to read that.
And, yeah, that looks very interesting.
Yeah. So I don't know what else you want to, what else you'd like to talk about here.
If someone's interested in getting involved with, as an activist, environmental justice, what would you recommend or suggest? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's. I think that most people, you know, they want to feel. It has to be. It has to be a subject that you're passionate about. So, it has to be an issue that really seems to speak to you on some level.
Not just something to go out and claim I volunteered for this or I did this. You have to
you won't become an activist. I mean, you might volunteer a day here, a day there, but it's not going to really engage you, mind, body, soul,
right?
Unless it's something you're passionate about. Now, sustaining your activism is something that a good group will, you know, recognize your efforts, will reward you with actually giving you a role to play within the organization. We'll continue to have the respect and recognition and rewards of being a part of a group. A lot of people, I mean, what keeps a lot of us going is the camaraderie.
Yes.
It's the people that you meet in through this work, that the relationships that you form with others, and I guess it's probably the same kind of satisfaction a lot of people get from going to church,
right?
That kind of thing, you know, because there's no you're not getting paid to do this.
Okay.
It's not your job in the same formal way of understanding, you know, what a job is.
But, true.
You know, but true. You're part of something that's bigger than your own little personal soap opera.
And essentially have a spouse or family behind you that supports you.
Well, that helps.
That helps tremendously.
That helps. I got to be honest, when I first got involved with the Evergreen Alliance, my marriage was very problematic for me at that time. And I was not prepared to leave my husband and get divorced, because I was really very determined to maintain an intact family unit for our son. But a lot of the anger that I had about what was going on in my marriage, instead of turning it on my husband, I went out and I turned it. Took on a much bigger battle,
right?
But it was a way for me to channel a lot of my rage, and good news is that my marriage is much healthier today.
Good.
We've been able to, you know, kind of come full circle, and so I'm going to celebrate 32 years of marriage and the end of this month.
Congratulations!
Thank you. And yes, our son is going to be 31 next week. So, yes, I'm really happy to know that, you know, my husband and I have been able to hang tough, remain a family unit. That's what means so much to both of us.
That is very important, yes.
Yeah, especially, you know.
With the effort you've shown with the organizations and the activism, yes, that is very impressive.
Yeah, I'm so thankful that we've been able to, as I like to say, instead of sticking it to each other, we stuck it out. And now we have something really beautiful.
Yes,
you know?
And a son to be proud of.
Oh, a son that we are enormously proud of. So other than that, you know, I'm just, I don't know what else I can you here. Again, mentors through the years, my mother to start off with, and Rosalie Bertel, Lois Gibbs, Brenda Liveoak, notice A lot of women.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very strong women.
Strong women. And
outspoken women.
Outspoken women. That's right. Women who, you know, aren't afraid to be unpopular.
Right. Which was in 70s and 80s was, you know, not necessarily normal.
Well, I guess not. I don't think it's ever, I think that women still are, you know, I'm sure this is a case by case, but I still don't think that women are really encouraged to speak out. And I mean, you know, when in 08, when Obama and Hillary Clinton were vying it out for the Democratic nomination, I was working as a teacher's assistant at that time in a charter school over on the east side here in Detroit, and I was working in the third grade with and the teacher was an African-American woman, and I asked her, I said, so what do you think? You think fundamentally our country is more racist or more sexist? She said, absolutely more sexist. Absolutely, hands down. You know, women still don't get the respect for our leadership.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think so.
So, you know, we'll see what happens in 2016. I'm not necessarily a big fan of Hillary Clinton, but I would like to see a woman elected to be our president.
That would be an interesting time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It would.
And I would like, I want to see more and more women engaged in positions of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Not to diminish men, but just to raise the level out the playing field.
Right.
Let's just level out the playing field. That's all anybody's asking for.
Right.
The environmental justice movement. That's all anybody's asking for is let's just level out the playing field. You wouldn't think that that was so threatening, but it's hugely threatening.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just, you know, here with nuclear energy or incinerators.
Right. Well, no, in pretty much all aspects of society, you know, and so this continues to be part of the human, the social justice project that exists on planet Earth.
Yes.
And we're not going to run out of work to do for a long time.
let's see here.
Anything else?
Nothing else I can think of. I think you've been very thorough.
Okay, that's great.
You've lived a very interesting and determined life. And I mean that in a positive way. And I can, listening to you has been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks.
And eye-opening.
And this is the other. I'm not gonna give this to you. But if you want to look through it, and I can Xerox, you know, anything. This was a PhD project that Elaine Wellen. She interviewed a whole bunch of us in '96 women at the grassroots.
Right.
You know,
and I saw it online when I was doing searching, but of course it's not been scanned.
Okay.
So it's not available.
Okay.
So I did, see it annotated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we can sit and take a look at it. But I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, thank you.
For allowing me to sit here and talk with you. It's been, like I said, very interesting, very eye-opening. Mm-hmm. For contemporaries, we've had such different lives.
Mm.
You know, we're only like 3 years apart in age.
Okay.
But I can see the passion still in your eyes. And
oh, yeah.
And hear it in your voice.
Yeah.
And
I'm blessed. I'm blessed. You know, Maslow, you know, Alexander Maslow, the psychologist. I mean, there's that little pyramid, you know. Ground one. You got to make sure you got basics, food, clothing, shelter, fundamental things in place before you can advance to the next level of self-actualization. you know, and it moves up from there. I have been really blessed to have a solid, secure foundation in my life. Now, you know, I probably took a lot for granted growing up, but having been married to my husband for the last 32 years, he's helped straighten me out on all of that. He is a self-made man, okay. You know, came up from a very humble beginning, and he has really helped me understand what it means, you know, to put the roof over your head, to put the food on the table, to ensure a stable foundation,
right.
You know, and then to go from there to advance yourself. And so I've been really blessed, you know, to have that kind of secure foundation upon which to build,
yes,
and develop, you know, my character, and to be more self-actualized,
and to have the experiences growing up with your mother's,
yes,
volunteer activities, and
oh, yeah,
you said your aunt also,
yeah,
and
yeah,
your scouting, and that all has led you,
oh,
to this.
It all goes into it, without, yes, a doubt. And I think too, you know, I had my mom, I had all these really amazing women, you know, influencing me, you know, growing up, but I also saw, you know, my dad, who was just totally, you know, in support of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, of course, a very passionate, you know, person himself, and the kinds of, you know, his sailing and just his love of the outdoors, and, you know, so just, I mean, together my parents were really great, you know, role models,
right,
you know, for me. I have a cousin who's been quite an activist herself, and so she's 8 years older than me. She's also had a really positive influence on me. So, you know, and so we're all shaped by those around us.
We are. But thank you again.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
It's been enjoyable. And we'll end it now.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And we'll just sit and talk.
Okay.
How's that?
All right, great.